this week on the Inside Flap.
I've been here now full-time, kind of off-grid for a decade now. But in the early days, I often thought to myself, you know, if I was out for a walk in the woods, chopping wood or whatever, hauling wood back, and I broke my ankle, I didn't have my phone, it was winter, it was minus 25. Like, there's no hope, really. I'm just going to expire in the woods.
The first cop, he tried to kick the door down, but I guess the guy pulled a groin or something because he kind of limped away. So the other cop came up with a little mini battering ram. And they,
wouldn't the hotel have helped them out or no?
Well, it was, you know, he had bolted it from the inside.
Oh, one of this those guy little, wasn't coming out. Huh.
I said, well, what did it look like when they got it? I don't know. I stopped looking through the peephole.
The Inside Flap is available on demand and every week on iTunes, Spotify, and around the world on theinsideflap.com. What more can we do for you?
Podcasting live from Littleton, Colorado. This is the Inside Flap, a book podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Dave Medicus, and welcome to our show right here from Littleton. That's right. Seated across the room to my left is Laura Medicus.
Howdy.
And quarantining with... He's got COVID, but he's dead. He's tired from his second shot. He's got all kinds of stuff going on. Up in the mountains is Andrew Dowd. Andrew.
Excelsior.
Excelsior. We are so glad that you are on your feet. Well, I guess you're sitting down, but you're somewhat with us.
I feel like Andrew's been beat up the past couple weeks because of COVID.
Yeah, COVID.
He got his first shot, then got COVID.
Right.
Kind of had some effects from it. Then got the second shot and has been sick.
He is like a boxer in round 8. He's wobbly.
It's a little unfair.
A little punch drunk, but he's hanging in there. He's unshaven. I don't know if that has anything. I'm looking at his him on the camera here. He's a little unshaven.
You know, I feel like Rocky in the first Rocky episode. You know, goes the full distance and still loses. That's how I feel.
Right. Jeez, how easy. Spoiler alert now. Come on.
Spoiler alert for the 1984 Rocky, you mean?
That's a 1979 for you.
Is it 79?
I believe it's 1979, yes. Do you know Stallone was nominated for an Oscar for writing the original Rocky? Yep, that's correct. Maybe he won it. I don't know. In any case, we do not have Sylvester Stallone.
Only there was a way to check.
Doesn't he still live at home with his mother?
Oh, how dare
his
you!
His mother just Jackie's passed been away. Passed. Jackie passed has away. Passed. Come on, it's too.
I guess
too soon.
He lived too soon.
Too soon. Okay. It's too soon.
Thank you for silencing your phone. Also, here is that Jackie Stallone on the phone?
That's right.
Yeah. Calling in.
Jackie.
That's Sylvester coming after me here.
You're for the birds. Now,
is that your Jackie Stallone?
That's my Jackie
impression?
Stallone. Yeah. Huh. It's for the birds. We do have a great guest for you this week. Today's episode, we have author Will Dean. Hey.
Oh, yeah.
Will Dean. Now, we've
Will's
been big.
Back again.
Yeah, Will's back. We had him. Andrew and I chatted with him 2 years ago. I went back through the archives, which, by the way, you can still listen to at theinsideflap.com. Every episode, I believe, except for our first five or six.
Yeah.
Even when we talked to Will in episode 22, we still didn't know what the hell we were doing.
A little shaky,
but he's back on the show 2 years later. Laura and I chatted with him. He's got a great book out. Listen, we've been fans of his for a long time, so it was great to talk to him again. His new book is called The Last Thing to Burn, and we'll have that chat for you in just a little bit. Yes, Andrew.
So is Will still living in the forest?
He is. He is still in the forest in Sweden. Yep. And that was the first thing I checked in with him to make sure. But yeah, he's still there getting it done.
Now, has he had any fans just like show up at random out there?
Well, you see, this is why we needed you on the interview to find out. I don't know. I did not ask him that. I mean, I don't want to put thoughts in the guy's head. I mean, he's in the middle of a Scandinavian forest, you know, hours.
I think we should do is we should fund a trip for Dave Medicus to go to Sweden.
All right, yeah.
And to stalk him in the woods.
Oh God. Could you guys ever live in a place that remote? Because I could not.
Mr. Dean, I've got a copy of your book over here. No, I couldn't. No.
I don't think I'd last a week.
And he's got a little kid. He's got a big dog.
I would
dog,
not be able to do it.
A wife.
Like he said, you go out to chop firewood and you know, like if something happens, people, you might not be found.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
I loved how he was talking about how he had to drop his kid off to school. He said, I dropped my kid off from school in the two forests over, or the other forest over, not the other town over, the other forest over. So everything is referenced by forest over there, I guess. But in any case, it was great to chat with him. We'll have that for you in just a little bit. Of course, we have our
book reviews,
book recommendations, and the
audiobook
of the week. But first, a quick story for you guys. So my parents were back in town and good to see. So they're down there in Arizona. They came up to, and I do have...
Now, David.
My mom and
hello.
My dad both coming up to see Sylvia as she had a marching band performance. And shout out to Littleton High School and Mr. Emmons, the marching band instructor, as he told us, and as far as we can tell, this is the only marching band in the entire state of Colorado that has put on a field show this year. So we cannot say, we are just so grateful to Mr. Emmons for all he's done for these kids. And as he told me, it's just sheer persistence. He just kept calling.
This is the guy, like we had the CDC at our first football game. This week, which is weird.
Mm-hmm.
There were two members of the CDC there to observe.
Making sure that all the protocols were in place.
Yeah.
Which they were.
Except.
It's funny now that I think about it. That first game, they were taking our temperatures. Yeah. They were checking the list, checking it twice. And by the last game we just went to.
The thing is, though.
No temperatures.
There's no mask mandate if you're outside anymore.
That's true. And there's no more mask mandate at the game. So I guess why would they? But they weren't even like checking. There was no Santa Claus.
High school kid. Come on in.
Come on over. And it actually felt like football weather as we're sitting out there in the snow watching the game. For those of you keeping score at home, and I know Andrew kept inquiring about the score, as we're sitting out there in 20-degree weather, heavy, wet snow coming down on us. And, of course, I gave my brand-new stadium chair to my mom to sit on, so she could sit. She was in the lap of luxury over there.
It was very nice of you.
I was on the cold...
Can you imagine if you hadn't done that, though?
Metal bench.
What kind of monster would you be?
David, why am I sitting on the metal bench and you're in your Florida State University stadium chair?
Yeah, that's a good point. But we left after the band played at halftime, and the band did as well. But the score at half was 42-0 in favor of the visitors, not Littleton. So, you know, kudos to those boys for going out there. Mm. You know, it can't be easy to go out there and get your butts whipped every single week.
I think they've won one game in 4 years.
Yeah, the other game that I had gone to, I think the score was something like, 56-0 at halftime. So they're not really, God bless them. They're out there. They're trying,
They're getting yelled at by the coach.
Their punter. I got a few choice words for their punter, but we'll save that for our high school football podcast that we do on late Sunday night. So check that one out. That's high school football podcast.com. But I got to tell you this. So wanted to give a quick shout out to the hotel that my parents stayed at. Now, listen, we got a small house here. We don't have a whole lot of room. And I think the last time my parents stayed here, my dad complained of dizziness as they slept in the basement.
Yeah.
So they're not keen on spending another night in our house for whatever reason. I don't know why, what the deal was with the dizziness.
I forgot about that.
But he did definitely blamed it on the basement. But in any case, they're at the motel that they're staying at. They picked out.
Okay, being the operative word.
M being the operative word. And when I went over there, and said, the next day to pick them up. Hey, how was your stay? You're going to be here 3-4 nights. How was your first night at the hotel? My mom informed me, well,
It was nice. You know, your father got a good show this morning. I don't know, what do you mean? He got a show? What kind of, was there a Broadway review come and hit the marching band come over? Well, he was looking out at the peephole, and it was the police department. And apparently what happened is there was a guy holed up in the room right across the hallway from theirs. And, you know, the cops were,
Edgewater, please open up. Edgewater, please open up.
Except it'd be interesting if they were in Edgewater.
I don't know where exactly they were. But they weren't. The guy wasn't answering, so they had to take the old. And my dad said he was watching through the peephole as he heard the banging. The first cop, he tried to kick the door down, but I guess the guy pulled a groin or something because he kind of limped away. So the other cop came up with a little mini battering ram, and they
wouldn't the hotel have helped them out or no?
Well, it was you know, he had bolted it from the inside.
Oh, one of this those guy little, wasn't coming out.
Yeah, no, this guy was in there. He wasn't coming out, so they had to you know, bash the door down and get the guy out of there. Huh. I said, well, what did it look like when they got? I don't know. I stopped looking through the peephole. So I guess he got he got bored. But
must have been a slow.
I saw the door. There was like a little piece of plywood taped over to the area where the little latch it was.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wonder what kind of extra room charges you get for the battering ram.
Not only, sir, yeah, I know you're on your way to prison to be arrested for whatever dreadful, heinous crimes you committed. But listen, we got a little surcharge here. Sir, if you don't mind signing for the, or maybe the cops take care. Who does take care? Probably the hotel. I don't know. I don't know who would take care of that.
Insurance?
Yeah, chalk it up to insurance.
I don't know.
The guy going to prison isn't going to pay for it, but he's not going to pay for his room either. You know, it probably just... I mean, somebody's got to pay for it. Maybe my parents
pay
for it.
Maybe the cops pay for it. I don't know. They're the ones who caused the damage.
You know, free continental breakfast on the way out. banging down doors. It burns a lot of calories. But
I wonder how often that happens.
I mean, it just randomly happened on the one time. It happened all the time.
Hmm. Well, you know, that's one awesome hotel. People are literally breaking down the door to get in.
Breaking down the doors to get in, yeah. But I did feel a little guilt about that. But, you know, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? Laura, how's your week been?
Well, it, you know, Colorado and other parts of the country.
The Rado, as we call it, the Rado.
In other parts of the country.
Yes.
When it's springtime, it rains. Mm. It does something called rain.
That's right.
In Colorado, when it's springtime...
I've got sound effects of other
it
states.
Snows. It snows.
Right.
And, you know, when you first move here, you're like, oh, that's interesting. We have snow in April. We have snow in May. Mm-hmm. But then after you've been here a while, you're just like, why can't it just rain like a normal state?
Yeah.
Like, why can't we just get spring rain? So we've had a series of spring snowstorms. Over and over and over
again.
Got
another one coming tomorrow.
Yeah. And we had one yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And I have spring fever. I planted my... Once I kicked the baby bunnies out, which they grew up and left. So
You didn't kick them out. No. You wanted to kick them out.
I did, but I didn't.
In fact, remember when you took the leaf blower to the nest and tried to blow the baby bunnies out of the garden? Remember that?
No such thing. So I planted cold weather vegetable seeds, right? Yes, did that.
Carrots, lettuce.
And I've just had a plant craving. So I went to the Home Depot and I hit the jackpot because...
Andrew's favorite store.
That's true. I didn't, I missed you there, Andrew.
Yeah.
And I...
well, he's down the one over in Edgewater.
Edgewater. So I hit the jackpot and like all these hanging baskets and plants, they're unloading them from the thing. And it was super exciting. People were elbowing each other, but we're also really like pumped.
I mean, literally the big truck had just pulled up to the Home Depot, right?
It
they were pulling them off the truck.
Exciting.
You got them off before they even
and
stuck
so
the little
I
labels
saw
on.
I got a bunch of different plants. And yeah. One of them that I got was a spider plant, which my mom had a spider plant in like the 70s, 80s, whatever. I remember it. And I haven't seen a spider plant until recently. At my upholsterer has a monster spider plant, like one of those that looks like it could take on Milwaukee or something like that. Just a big old spider plant. And ever since I saw it, I was like, I really want a spider plant. I need to have a spider plant. Mm. So I had that in my head. Lo and behold, spider plants, it came home with me.
Now, why do they call it a spider plant?
Because the babies that come off of it look like little spiders, little leggy spiders.
Yeah, I guess
so. I bring this plant into the home, set it on the countertop with the other plants, and Honey, our cat, immediately hops up. He's very excited. And
she's not calling me honey. She's referring to the cat's name.
He starts grazing among the plants.
Yes.
And so I let him have a little nibble here and there. But then I notice like he can't keep away from the spider plant in particular. So he is like tearing up this plant. And like it's like nubs are starting to form. So I grab the spider plant and I end up like kind of moving it from room to room. He is so fixated on this plant. It's like I brought like a live bird into the home.
I mean, he's following it around.
He's trotting around. He's got
his little head sticking up towards the ceiling, looking up at you.
He would jump off a bridge to try to get this plant. Like he would endanger himself to get this plant. I ended up having to lock it into the bathroom. And I looked up and then he knows it's in there. He's running around the house. He's so excited. I looked up the spider plant and cats and turns out spider plants are a mild hallucinogenic for cats.
Whoa.
Yes. Wow. So Honey was getting high off the spider plant.
That's right.
Yeah. So
now Laura, that's a very appropriate 420 story.
It is 420.
Oh, it is 420. Thank you. Yeah. Honey. Hadn't planned it. And just in case someone out there wants to know, I did look it up. It does not apply to humans. So any human that's thinking they could get high off of the spider plant, it just applies to cats. And they don't believe it applies to dogs, just cats. So
We ended up
hanging the spider plant in the kitchen.
Yeah.
What else? What else, Dave?
Well, it's like catnip, right?
Yeah, catnip's the same way. Mm-hmm. Weird, right?
Yeah.
So strange. What do cats have that other mammals don't necessarily? Well, they're insane. Completely insane. So we do have it hanging in the kitchen, and he cannot get to it. He's tried multiple times, has tried to bite it and get it.
You got it hanging up high off the ceiling.
I've got it up hanging up high, yeah. And then I was a loon, and I decided I needed macrame plant holders because I really wanted that retro look.
Yeah.
So I have it hanging from a macrame.
And you didn't actually have to go back, time travel back to the 70s to get that macrame either.
Sadly, Amazon made it in China. I looked on Etsy because I was like, I'll get someone who's hand making these and whatever.
Yeah.
All the one on Etsy, they were all made in China too. So I just went on Amazon and bought it for half the price at Etsy. Yeah. So anyway, that's my home decorating, home gardening story.
Yep, home gardening.
Oh,
remember that?
And then
yes,
I saw something and I wondered about this. I saw someone call our spring sprinter, which would be a combination of winter or spring.
Wow, it's the worst thing I've ever
but
heard.
What about like wing?
Sprinter.
Wing?
Wing.
I think sprinter.
No, why do we have to have words for
sprinter?
No, we don't. Everybody's so quick that they need to put a label on them.
It's a
it all
mess,
started
Dave.
With brunch.
Every other day,
it all
it's
started
snowing.
With brunch. Yeah, in fact, you remember that time when I told Andrew
brunch is
remember,
great. I like brunch.
Remember when Andrew said, "I'm putting away the snowblower"? I'm like, "What are you doing? It's April." Yeah, exactly. It's April. Completely forgot that.
So
it's wishful thinking.
Lest we forget, Colorado is a very arid state. So we're grateful to see any moisture in whatever form it so chooses.
You're right. You're right. And that's what everybody says. So if you start complaining about the snow out here, people will say, yes, but we need it. And so we do know
so
that.
It's so nice to have the moisture.
The moisture.
So Laura, you got my creative gears turning. But
yes.
I can see a cat cartoon, sort of a very sarcastic cat cartoon with a bunch of stoner cats hanging around with spider plants and catnip.
Oh, I love it. And macrame.
Yeah, I do have some audio of some stoner cats here.
All I need are some tasty waves, cool buzz, and I'm fine.
There you go.
That's awesome.
That's the rebirth of Sean Penn's career.
Yes.
That's right. That's right. Andrew, how has your week been? apart from the COVID and the waves of exhaustion. I look over at the monitor here, and he's just rubbing his temples.
Do you have a headache? Because I heard that it causes a headache.
You know, I had a little bit of a headache. And so on Saturday, I got my second vaccine, and I'd just gotten over COVID. At least I think I was over COVID. But, you know,
I shouldn't laugh.
But, you know, I'm not one to procrastinate. So I had that second shot scheduled.
Yeah. Well, you want to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And come hell or high water, as long as I could crawl in that damn door, I was getting that shot.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, you know, basically a guy named Thor is the pharmacist who basically gave me that second shot. And I will say, you know, he was a pharmacist and he's also doing it. He's literally running back and forth between the pharmacy counter and back there basically administering, you know, vaccine shots.
Hmm.
And I asked him, I said, Thor?
No, wait, was his name really Thor?
His
name was really Thor.
Wow.
Did he have long, flowing, golden locks?
No.
Did he have bulging biceps?
He looked more like Thor in the one movie with the beer gut, Thor.
Okay.
So, but he was sweating. He was running back and forth. I'm like, you know, do you get paid any extra during COVID? He's like, absolutely not. He's like, you know, if they say if we don't like it, we can just leave. But, you know, I really felt for the guy, you know. Mm. So, you know, but basically the first 24 hours, the second vaccine, no issues. But then, you know, I'd say Sunday it hit me. I just like hit a wall and just been, and I've just been tired and exhausted. Mm. So I think I'm over the worst of it, but you know, I'm just completely run down. And part of it too, is we had COVID at the house. The kids are just wrapping up homeschooling. You know, we've probably done between the five of us, 30 some different COVID tests.
Now, we know Mary Kate had it, your little one, but has anyone else tested positive?
Yeah, just myself. Myself and Mary Kate.
You got the lucky stick.
Lucky stick, Andrew.
Yeah, boy!
But we've had nasal swabs, we've had the saliva tests, we've had the blood tests. I mean, you know, I'm just glad there's not a... what do you want to call it?
A rectal exam, yes.
Rectal COVID test, because we would have had to do that one too.
That's the one. You do not want that one, no.
Yeah.
You know.
So much blood!
Oh, God, yeah. No.
I hope not.
Geez, no.
But, you know, so it's just, but we're just about done, and I think this is likely our COVID chapter, but it's so funny, like, the house of five people, and we are the two to get it, right? And our kids are like, you know, doing the same thing, drinking out of the same cup. I mean, you know, all that stuff. So it makes no sense.
Yeah.
Really interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what else is interesting, and that is Will Dean's new book, The Last Thing to Burn. Now, listen, this is a propulsive, highly addictive, razor-sharp, and rapidly moving thriller that is at times disturbing, extremely intense. And, you know, this is a book that's just going to grab you tight and not let you go until you are finished. I read this baby. Listen, I sat down on the back patio, plopped down with this book, and I could not stop reading it until I was finished it. I just knew, it was one of those books where...
on the other hand...
It sucks. Well, hold on. Okay. You can talk about your experience reading the book, but I had to know how this baby was going to end. This is a... story about a woman being held captive, and I was captivated by it and just had to, you know, her story sucked me right into it, and I just had to find out, was she going to make it out alive, yes or no? So that's why I couldn't stop. Yes.
I found it so unrelenting and so terrifying.
These are good words for it, yes.
That I could not read it at night before I went to sleep because I was afraid it would affect my sleep.
Yeah.
I'm not making that up.
This is a book that will seep into your subconscious. And like Will says, like, he doesn't think he's ever written, and he keeps getting letters from people. Well, I don't know if he gets letters. Who the hell? Well, it's the sweetest forest. You know, where else? Of course, he's going to. Does the postman get.
What do you think? Hedwig is out there dropping letters.
We should have asked him how far he has to drive to get to his mailbox. But yeah, he gets.
I bet he has a P.O. box.
Comments.
He has to check, right?
Yeah, probably. Comments. From people about how insidious his main character is. And as he said, you know, this is a guy, he doesn't think he'll ever write a guy as monstrous as this guy is. So anyway, the book tells the story of Jane, not her real name, a victim of human trafficking who has been held captive by a man on his remote and isolated farm in the United Kingdom. In fact, she has been held captive by this man for 7 years. And every day she, in her mind, plots out how she can escape, while every day he checks the tapes of the cameras that are everywhere to make sure nothing untoward has happened. And how could it? I mean, how can she escape? She's kept in perpetual physical agony, the damage he's done by smashing in her ankles, as well as the mental torture she's constantly in. This is dark. Now, you know, I like my stories dark, so I did like this one. This is dark territory you're in. If you're a fan of books like Misery and Room, you're going to love this one. I talked about Will's Tuva books, been a big fan of his. He's created this one is just a straightforward roller coaster ride of a book. You just want to strap yourself into and ride right until the end, just like a good roller coaster. It'll leave you breathless and exhilarated. I love this book, and I love chatting with Will. Always, he's just a real nice guy. Mm-hmm. Great to chat with, easy to talk to, and here that conversation is for you right now. This is Will Dean talking about his new book, The Last Thing to Burn.
I am. I'm still in the cabin in the woods. So it's been interesting being here for the last year. Well, actually, it hasn't been that much of a big change in a lot of ways.
Like you're the one guy, you're the one family in the world who didn't have to worry about COVID. That's pretty cool.
I know. We were like apocalypse ready by accident. We didn't plan it that way.
How's your dog?
He's really good. Thank you, Laura. He's good. He's not fully grown yet, but he's 90 kilos. So he's very, very ridiculously big, but he's lovely. He's very gentle. He's a gentle giant.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. But cool. I like seeing the pictures you post on Twitter.
Yeah.
The cat, he's very photogenic.
Yes, he is.
And the cat is just a giant, maybe not so gentle.
Oh yeah.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Bernie has no aggression, but he's just hefty, and Monty has all the aggression, so he's the boss for sure. Yeah.
Monty, I like that name. That's a good one.
That's cute.
Yeah.
Well, Will, we loved your new book, The Last Thing to Burn. Listen to me, Will. I'm telling you right now, I literally think my palms are still sweaty from reading this damn thing. For me, it was great because I just sat down. I sat on the one afternoon on the back patio, cracked it open, and just stayed in that place the whole time. Didn't leave it. I feel like that to me would be the ideal, or at least it worked out for me. I loved it. I think maybe some other people, wink, wink, might maybe needed to take a little time away from the book as they were.
It was very intense.
Yeah. This was so.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
So intense. I think I got a couple nervous, sweaty panic attacks while I was reading it. But I loved it so much. I really, really enjoyed the book. What was it that inspired you to write this one, Will? A standalone.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, first of all. And honestly, I felt the same way when I was writing it. Like Laura was talking about, I needed to take breaks, and I had a knot in my stomach the whole time because I was so worried about the main character because I didn't really understand the ending when I started it. And yeah, it's the most tense thing I've ever written, for sure. Maybe that I will ever write. I don't know. It's very claustrophobic. And
yes.
And the in terms of like the genesis of the book, it came to me, the idea came to me in 2016, one night at midnight. Yeah. I was lying down in bed, my wife was asleep, and I was just in that weird borderland between wakefulness and sleep. And I saw in my mind's eye, from an aerial perspective, a small cottage, a small two-bedroom dwelling in the fens in this very flat, bleak farmland in the UK. And I saw, again, from above, a woman walking in and out of the cottage and around, but she never went very far. So that's the image I had at midnight. Yeah, yeah. It's
wow.
Wow. It's a very simple premise, really. Yeah. And there are only two main characters. You know, it's been likened to Room by Emma Donoghue and Misery by Stephen King. And I think that's kind of this, it's that kind of genre or subgenre. But But yeah, I wanted to know what her story was. And there are two characters, her and her captor. And I didn't want, I wasn't interested in him so much. I wanted to understand her backstory and what she was doing. And the book took me 5 years from start to finish. Oh, because really? I wanted to do her justice. You know, I'm writing someone who I don't share those experiences. So I really wanted to do my research and get early readers from that background and understand something more about it so that it would read authentically and it would be kind of sensitively done.
You're always getting these visions, Will. I'm jealous of your vision. I remember you got you were talking about the vision you had of Tuva, the same thing. Maybe we're all getting visions, but you just are smart enough to act upon them.
That could be.
I don't know. I don't know if it's smart sometimes, but it's, I don't know. I think we all have these little ideas, or we're all to some extent open to a new story, and it's just a matter of kind of plucking them out of the air sometimes and giving them room to breathe and develop into a full story. Mm-hmm. So that night, for example, at midnight, like sometimes I have an idea or a seed of an idea, and I kind of write a note on my phone, or I think I'll remember that, and I go to sleep and it's gone forever. And it wasn't meant to be, but this time I felt something visceral about this premise, and I stayed awake until 6 a.m. and I kind of daydreamed my way through the whole story. So by 6 a.m. I had the whole book.
Wow.
And that's never happened to me before.
Wow. So I had trouble reading the book at night in particular, like right before I went to bed, I was like, I can't do this to myself because I'm going to dream about her all night long. So I had to switch, you know, and do a backup book.
You're picking up Garfield comic strips. Yeah.
Yeah. And then come back to her during the daylight hours. But after I finished your book, I took a walk and I found myself wondering how many women are held captive around here.
Right.
And
yeah.
I, because you hear about it, especially where we live in the States all the time. Mm-hmm. Did you find yourself looking around isolated farms, wondering that?
not specifically that, but I'm from that part of the world. So I grew up in that rural, bleak landscape. So I'm very familiar with how isolated it is and how distant the people are and how easy it would be theoretically to hide something awful, whatever it would be.
Yes.
And like you say, you know, I've got overactive imagination. So whenever I go past a house, drive past a house, walk past a house, I'm always thinking, what's the story behind the closed doors? Because everything can look perfect from the outside, but I hope nothing bad is going on, but sometimes there is something bad going on. And I guess for me, it's the intersection of landscape and character that I find really interesting, both with the Tuva novels and the fact that she hates nature and she hates the wilderness. And in this book, the fact that, you know, whereas in Misery and in Room, the person who's being held captive can't really see safety in the distance.
Yeah.
They're very much locked down. In this book, because the landscape is so flat and because our main character has a reasonably normal day-to-day life, as in she kind of does her chores and she eats and she walks around, but she can always see into the distance churches, for example, which is supposed to be safety and sanctuaries. She sees roads with trucks and she can never reach them.
Yeah. Mm.
And that really felt horrific to me. The fact that she's confronted with that possibility every day and she can't quite get there.
Yes. It's a horrific landscape and she could smell the sea, but she couldn't see it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
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 Yeah. It was very atmospheric. It was like, you know, I think there are two places where you can't, they'll never hear you scream in space and in the English countryside in your book.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and as someone who lives in an extremely isolated place now, full town by choice,
I thought of that.
Like I can walk for roughly a day in any direction from my wooden house, and I'm still in the same forest, and there's nobody there.
Wow.
So yeah, like I'm sometimes, especially in the early days, I've been here now full time, kind of off grid for a decade now. But in the early days, I often thought to myself, you know, if I was out for a walk in the woods, chopping wood or whatever, hauling wood back, and I broke my ankle, I didn't have my phone, it was winter, it was minus 25. Like there's no hope really. I'm just going to expire in the woods. And we're so used to that thing of having a neighbor or having a cell phone reception or having help at hand to some extent that extreme isolation, like being in space, is scary for us because we're inherently social creatures to some extent. So it is scary when we can't get help when we need it.
Yeah.
You were the right guy for this job, for this book. I mean, you know a thing or two about yeah. isolation, and it shows. Did you, did you look into one of the major themes of this book is human trafficking. Did you do any research and look into human trafficking while
I did. I did. Before I started writing it, actually, I had the idea, and then I thought to myself, like, do I even have the right to tell this story? Like, how do I do this properly and do the main character justice and her story justice? So I stepped away from it as soon as I had the idea, and I did 6 months of solid reading and research and wow. listening to interviews and reading interviews and studying NGO documents and charity documents and stuff and trying to understand more about that world. Even though I don't go into great depth about that world, I wanted to understand it so that I could pull out the pieces that I wanted to for this story. So yeah, that's another reason why it took me 5 years instead of 1 year is that once I wrote the first draft, which I wrote in 3 weeks, like that was another kind of exorcism where it just came out of me very fast. But then I wanted to go over it and rewrite it and work on it. And I want, you know, my sister-in-law is Vietnamese and her family, so they live in Vietnam. I wanted to talk to them about it and discuss themes with her. I've got a friend who's half Vietnamese. I wanted her to read it if possible before it was published and give me feedback. And that she was amazing. And another friend who is like a counselor professionally for victims of trafficking. She was fantastic. She read an early copy. So I wanted to just make sure I did this the right way. I didn't want it published if it was going to be gratuitous or, yeah. you know, just wasn't right. So yeah, that's why it took me half a decade.
I also thought it was interesting. Well, one YouTube video on how to give birth at home, and Lynn's like, "Yeah, I'm good. I've got this.
I can birth a child. I can." Yeah.
And Tom's like, "No, you don't have this. You need to get a doctor for me or watch another video." Did you watch any birthing videos to be able to write that scene? That, as a woman who has given birth, that was a horrific scene.
Yeah,
it was terrifying.
Yeah, I apologize for that scene.
Thank you.
I didn't watch any birthing videos all the way through.
I wouldn't have either. Good. I could not have done that.
No, but I was aware that they exist, you know, on YouTube in their thousands, so they're there for him to search. And I think that just goes to Len being such a vile, evil character. He is so quietly arrogant and sure of himself that he thinks he can do everything. He thinks he understands what it would be like for her to do this. You know, he often says things like, "There's no need to complain. Women have been doing it for thousands of years. My mother," you know, this kind of typical old school chauvinistic comments, misogynistic right. comments. And he is like the ultimate misogynist yeah. in a way. And yeah, I mean, all of those scenes came to me very quickly. That is one of the scenes that came to me that night between midnight and 6 a.m. I knew that he would have this terrible attitude towards the food that they eat, towards her motherhood, towards just every aspect of her life, to her privacy. You know, he doesn't allow her to close doors. Yeah. He's installed CCTV in every room. They're kind of different layers upon layers of horror.
Yes.
literal layers of horror in this
one. It was hard when he spread that tarp down that was dirty. I was like, oh no.
I don't think I will ever write a character that I loathe as much as I loathed him all the way through this process. I really despised him and still do, and I get letters and emails now. You know, it's not published, this book, The Last Thing to Burn, isn't published in the US and Canada until April 20th, but it's been out in the UK, Australia, South Africa now for 2 or 3 months. Okay. And I'm getting letters and emails saying, you know, I blame you because I didn't sleep last night, I had to read it all the way through in one sitting, and Len, I don't want, you know, why did you create this character? And I get requests for prequels because people want to understand where he came from as well. Other people want to know, like, what was the thing with his mother? Yeah. And his mother, his late mother, is like a presence in the book, isn't she? She's kind of there in the.
I was so curious about her backstory. I felt like maybe we'll find the mother alive somewhere, hogtied, or I don't know. Like, the mom was just there mm-hmm. throughout the book. Yeah.
Yeah. She's like a character, even though she's not there. She's a strong character. And the way Len instructs our main character to cook specific dishes on specific days of the week.
Yeah.
In a very specific manner, the same as his late mother. Mm-hmm. That this is just terrifying for me for some reason. The fact that he wants to control that to such an extent, and he thinks the only way to run a house or to cook is the way his late mother did. That's the only way. It's that kind of almost psycho kind of dynamic.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. The really scary thing is he thinks he's living his best life. He's there on the couch with Tana at night, his arm around her. They got football on the TV. He's like, not bad, huh? Not bad, not bad. It's like, what? Wow. You know, he is so psychotic and so deranged. And he's systematically for years been burning the personal effects of his captive Tan. One of those personal effects is her copy, or that she has that she holds near and dear to her, is her copy of Steinbeck's Of Mice and Men. What is this an important book for you?
It is. I mean, I came from a house with no books when I was growing up. None of my family were bookish. They all left school at like 15, 16. I was the only one to continue in school. I was the only reader. Wow. They all thought I was quite a weird kid for reading so much and asking to go to the library all the time. So that was one of my school texts, as it is with a lot of kids. And yeah, I found it really, it was one of the first American novels, great American novels that I'd read. And I found it really affecting back then when I was like 13 or whenever I read it. So, and it also has that parallel story within it of escape and of hope and of dreams that you never quite realize. So I wanted her to kind of see that through the eyes of George and Lenny, of trying to get to that little shack with the rabbits and the alfalfa patch. Like, it's a similar thing. And that she's even though he is so horrific and his life is so horrific, she always has hope. I didn't want this to be completely bleak. Yeah. She always has a twinkle of hope. Like, she remembers very fondly her family back home and the festivals and the food and the neighbors and things like that. And then she has the book that gives her a lot of comfort and escape in a way that like fiction does for all of us, especially this past year. Fiction is very comforting. And then she also has, once her baby is born, she has that extra drive of, I need to do everything I can to make sure that I have a future, but also that my child has a future. Mm-hmm. And as a mother, as a woman, she is the strongest character I've ever written, for sure. Her levels and depth of resilience is just kind of amazing.
It really is. And we see that throughout her captivity. And one of the things that I think helps her go along is she holds on to her name. Like, so every time he calls her Jane, she tells us, my name is not Jane. And it's like, she's just grasping at that, that's the only thing. If he can burn up all her personal effects, but if at least she can cling to her identity, that's something that's really important for her. And I like how you showed that.
Thank you. Yeah, that was really important to me. She, in an introspective way, within her own self, is holding on to a lot of herself and her identity, even though he is systematically eroding it at every opportunity. So like you said, with the burning of objects, you know, he has lots of possessions. She has four by the time we get to page one of this book.
Right.
She has her ID card, which is the last thing in her own language. She has Of Mice and Men. She has a photo of her parents. And she has the letters from her sister. And every time she does something that displeases Len, he's not like every day a violent man at all. He has this cold menace. So he will say to her, choose one of your remaining possessions. And then she has to make that active choice. And then he will burn it in front of her very calmly on the Rayburn stove fire that night. And that is another thing. It's like you were saying, Dave, about, you know, sitting down and watching the football and saying, it's not a bad life, is it? We're doing all right. Roof over our heads. It's really quietly disturbing. And I found it just very unsettling writing it.
That's a good word. Unsettling. Unsettling is a really good word.
Yeah. And then this farmhouse that she's trapped in is metaphorically and literally rotten. You know, the floor that's squishy in places gave me the willies, this feeling with the mold floor. When this came to you, were you envisioning this soggy, damp, rotting farmhouse? It's fast.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And that bathroom that he built on the back of the is really, I feel it. That sense of damp and cold and the squidgy floor that's not solid. I'm kind of familiar with some of these kind of places. Like where I was from, it was very agricultural, quite poor, like a few blue collar towns, but very, very kind of old fashioned. A lot of people didn't have a fridge still, things like that.
Wow.
Yeah. So really basic life for a lot of people. And I moved around a lot when I was a kid. I moved like 10 times, 12 times or something when I was a kid. And one of the places we moved into three, 2 years or something. But when we moved in, it was damp and it felt bad, inherently bad as a structure. Like I remember it had carpets, you know, which is this very English thing. And the carpets just felt really dirty. And I moved there when I was, I don't know, it was a very cheap place. I moved there when I was maybe 12. And I felt really kind of sad that underfoot, it wasn't something that I could feel comfortable with, you know? So we're scrubbing and scrubbing and we got it to a state where it was okay. But yeah, I am familiar with that kind of bad housing. It's pretty common in the UK. And even here in Sweden, in the cities, everything's very modern and well built. But in the countryside, you know, some people still live in a very simple way.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, speaking of living in a very simple way, you're out there in the woods. Now, how does it work for you? Now, it sounds like you still have the same way of writing your first draft, which is it's up here and I just got to get it out. I'm going to work at a breakneck pace to get it all out there as fast as I possibly can. Now, I'm picturing you underneath, and I'm sure this is not true, but this is what I picture in my mind. You're out there, you know, maybe you take a little sack lunch with you. You walk into the woods. You find a nice big pine tree to sit down underneath. You got your laptop, and you start hammering away. Enlighten me. How does the process work for you?
That would be good for like a newspaper piece or something, but it's not true, unfortunately. It's not that romantic. I have a small spare room in the house that we built. Mm. And in the morning, I write a chapter. I write a scene. And I have the blinds pulled. I have like a desk facing wall, earplugs in. So I'm just focused in that world. And then over lunch, I walk my dog and stuff, and I do the dishes or whatever he's doing. But I'm very much thinking about the next scene. And then in the afternoon, I'll write another scene the same way. And then in the evening, you know, I'll do the things that I need to do. I'll pick up my kid from school in the next forest and things like that. But I'm not very mentally present. Like, I'm very much still in the head of the protagonist. I go to sleep thinking about the next scene, and then I wake up kind of thinking about it. What am I going to write? And then I go into the next. So it's like I can't stop that cycle. Yeah. I feel like it's very exhausting holding up a fictional universe that I've created and all these characters. And I can't do that for very long. I'm exhausted after 3 or 4 weeks, but I couldn't do it for 6 months. I feel like if I did it for 6 months, like most sensible novelists would, then by the end, I've kind of forgotten what's happened at the beginning, or I've lost track, or the voice of those characters has evolved too much. So I feel like if I can get it out in 3 or 4 weeks, then it's quite whole and it's quite uniform, and it's something I can work with later on.
I like that. It really makes a lot of sense. Like just get into it. The same way I read your book, get into it, read it, and then get out. And of course, there's no getting.
Or draw it out like me.
Or draw it out like Laura did. I like how you casually drop in there that, oh, yeah, I had to go pick up my kid from school at the next forest over.
Yeah.
It's not so
yeah. Yeah, I think as soon as he turns 18, he'll move to, you know, London or New York or Hong Kong or something. Probably. To get away from here. Yeah,
yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. You got him chopping a lot of wood. How old is your son? You got him out there with the axe chopping up wood?
My wife gets a little bit nervous if I suggest that kind of thing. But he does a lot of good things. We built a treehouse last summer together, and he, you know, he had his little tool belt, and he's learning how to build stuff. And my wife teaches him how to cook and baking and stuff like that. So he's getting both sides of that. But yeah, he's a pretty well-rounded outdoorsman, as much as you can be when you're seven. Yeah, he loves it. He enjoys it. Yeah. And yeah.
That's good. And it helps to have a nice big dog around with you as you tromp around there. That's nice.
Yeah.
What kind of wildlife have you seen out there in the woods?
If I made a US comparison, it's a probably like Maine here. So it's not like a, quite like Alaska. So we have,
okay,
where we are, we have a lot of moose. So we have moose kind of trampling through the clearing.
That's awesome.
It's very cool. We have that every 3 or 4 weeks. We'll have a moose or a couple of moose come through. And then we have deer every day here. And then we have wolves, but they're not many wolves in Sweden. So I've only heard them once. Only heard one once. Wow.
That's all you needed here. That's enough.
I'll never forget it. Yeah, it had a real impact, like down to my bone marrow. Yeah. Felt like this is a true predator out there.
Yeah.
And then, but further north, there are more wolves and there are a lot of bears further north in Sweden. But yeah, is it like that in where you guys are? Or?
Yeah, what? There are wolves in northern Colorado, wolf packs that come in from Wyoming. They have a big range. We have mountain lions out here, bears. Yeah, all that.
Yeah. Okay. And this sounds quite similar. Yeah.
We live in the suburbs and we have coyotes roaming around.
That's true.
Bears come through. We have a friend who's seen a mountain lion or bobcat. Yeah.
All right, well, it's time for our segment we call Quick Six, six questions in which we find out a little bit more about you. Here we go. Will Dean, what is the last show you watched or binged and really enjoyed?
Normally, it would be something like Ozarks or something like that. But actually, now it's because of the relentless pandemic stuff. It's actually been the U.S. version of The Office.
Great.
Just because we need something light and something, and it's genuinely hilarious and it's so well written. And yeah, we've enjoyed it.
Perfect. That's a great one. We watched that again over the pandemic too.
We did. We absolutely did. Started at episode one, went all the way through it. I think it was my third time through the series. It never gets old.
So good. Yeah.
Yeah. What fictional world or place would you like to visit?
I mean, part of me is still very much a child inside. So, you know, I do have this very fond memory of reading the Narnia books for the first time, stepping back from through those fur coats and feeling the snow, and like that's an incredible premise. How he came up with that is just amazing. But another part of me, the dark side of me, would like to experience, or I mean, I wouldn't want to experience it, but I'd like to see the landscape of the dystopian, apocalyptic, post-apocalyptic landscape of The Road by Cormac McCarthy.
Oh yeah.
Wow.
Because I have such a strong image and feel of how grey and ashy and just horrific that landscape was. And this is my favorite book of all time, so I'd like to kind of experience
that. Oh, is
it
really? Nice. Yeah. How to go wrong with that one? How about this, Will? Do you have, give us a top five favorite movie of yours.
Wow. I think my favorite movie is probably The Godfather.
go to the mattresses. Go to the mattresses.
A lot of people maybe answer that question, but it's one of those movies you can watch again and again, and it's just so good. It's so beautifully done. It's such a good adaptation of the Mario Puzo novel, which I love.
Yeah.
And it's just a genius, genius movie. You know?
All right.
It's
very good.
Yeah.
We actually have not. Yeah. Actually, we have never gotten that response. You are the first one to.
You're the first.
Oh wow! Yeah. Okay, I'm glad. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah, in 3 years. So.
Yeah, how about a top five favorite book? It's a little harder, I know.
No, it's good. I'm going to go with Homegoing by Yaa Gyasi.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Which is not a crime novel. It's an incredible book. It's a debut. It's not very long. It came out a few years ago. It's set over 3 centuries. And 2 continents. So it starts off in Africa like 300 years ago, goes through different generations of families and people there, and then moves to North America at the end of the book. And it's incredible. I've never read a debut that is that ambitious and covers that much and is that kind of immersive. Like you get right into those different families and those different individual stories, but then they all string together perfectly and make sense at the end, and it's a powerhouse of a book.
And the name of that one again is?
It's Homegoing.
Awesome. Wow.
Yeah.
I wrote it down.
Really good.
Yeah. How about this, Will? Do you have a go-to karaoke song?
Wow. No, I've done karaoke once. You know, there's no karaoke bars in the forest.
No, right? I would nothing guess not. Yeah, no.
But I did do a karaoke with a bunch of other writers at a festival we kind of snuck off at 2 a.m. and somebody had booked a room and a bar, and we did a lot of karaoke, but I was mainly a spectator. I'm not singing is not one of my talents, but I did sing one song like at 5 a.m. and I think it was an Aha song, his biggest song. That, yeah. Aha, yeah. Uh-huh,
yeah. Yeah. Take on Maybe, me.
Take on me.
That's it. And I did like the chorus, which is like two words. And yeah, it was interesting. Yeah.
That's funny. And last but not least, what book are you currently reading?
I can't tell you which book I'm reading right now, honestly, because I'm judging a prize in the UK, and I have to read 12 books in a month, and the shortlist hasn't been announced. The big prize shortlist hasn't been announced, so I would get in big trouble.
Wow, yeah. That's exciting.
Look at you. Yeah, nice. Will Dean, how about that? Here's a guy who lives in the forest, chuck a bunch of books. He's got plenty of time to read.
Exactly, right? It's a lot of reading.
That is a lot of reading. Yeah.
And six fiction and six nonfiction. So it's quite nice. It's I can dip in and out, so it's good.
That's good.
But the last book that I read before that I can talk about is Watch Her Fall by Erin Kelly, which is a thriller set in the ballet world, which is a world that I don't know very well. It was really interesting, set in London, really, really good. Hmm. Enjoyed it.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I don't know anything about the ballet either.
I know a Black Swan. That's all I know is that movie, Black Swan.
Well, this book is Builders, Black Swan meets Killing Eve.
Oh my God, I'm in.
I love Killing Eve.
Yeah, right? It's a good it's a good comparison. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, listen, we loved your book so much. The Last Thing to Burn. I like that title, too, by the way. That's a good title.
Yeah, it's a great title.
Yeah, that really is. And a great book. And thanks for coming on again. Great to see you. And good luck with the book.
Thank you very much. I just want to say, you know, this is my debut in America. So I just feel extremely lucky and extremely happy that this is happening. And it's so lovely to speak to both of you again. So thanks for having me.
All right, you got it.
Thanks for coming on. It's a great book.
Yes, take care.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. The Inside Flap.
All right, there you go. That was Will Dean. Check out his new book, now available just out, fresh off the presses, The Last Thing to Burn. Remember, Andrew, remember that time when we talked to him 2 years ago and you called him Dean?
You know, you've got two first names.
I mean, I know. He's a man with two first names. You know,
I have a client.
I'm sure that's happened throughout his life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I have a client and their last name is Todd. And I have called the husband Todd on numerous occasions. And that is not his first name.
No.
It's not Todd.
We talked to a J. Todd. We guy J. Todd Scott. His middle name is Todd. Well, all right. Well, let's get to it. Time for, you know what? You know what we got to do? We got to open it up.
The library is officially open.
Time for some
book reviews. Yeah,
let's start with
Laura Medicus.
Laura, what do you have for us this week?
I have a book called The Butterfly Garden by Dot Hutchinson. Nice title.
Yeah, The Butterfly Garden. Yeah, sounds like a lovely,
peaceful
book about somebody going out and collecting butterflies.
Maybe a nice book to read in the spring.
Oh, it sounds
might be. Yeah,
sounds lovely. Yeah.
Except this is a story about a serial killer who kidnaps young women, takes them back to his remote greenhouse / bunker / weird mansion, and he keeps them there until their 21st birthday. And on their 21st birthday, they get embalmed and encased in acrylic for all eternity.
Whoa.
I know.
It rubs the lotion on its skin or else it gets the hose again.
There you go. There's a
thank you.
Hannibal Lecter-esque. Man.
Yeah.
Whoa.
He also, he tattoos elaborate butterfly wings on their backs. Some of them even get their faces tattooed with butterfly designs as well. And then he gives them these backless black dresses to wear. So it's young women wearing backless black, like evening gowns, wandering around this enormous greenhouse, like a butterfly garden, like you'd go, like a butterfly pavilion, which a lot of people have gone to.
Oh, sure.
I right pictured like the botanic gardens or numerous butterfly pavilions.
I believe I've been on several field trips with small children to the old butterfly garden.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so it's just young women with big tattoos of butterfly wings on their back wandering around.
Now, does he give them the tattoos
he's
himself?
He's very talented. They're described as actually beautiful tattoos.
This guy's
they're
a
very
man,
time-consuming.
A man of many skills.
And he adds color to them and everything.
Sure.
So at any given time, he's got about 10 girls in this bunker. And he calls them his butterflies. Mm. Of course.
What else is he going to call them? Yeah.
So, you know.
My ladies.
There's a greenhouse area. There's a huge, there's a waterfall. There's a pond. There's like a little cliff.
Mm.
There's a secure area where they sleep, where like the doors can go down. So if someone tries to come, let's say the cops get called, he can shut this door and it's really difficult to figure out that there's more rooms behind. Mm. Just like, oh, there's a nice, this guy's got a weird greenhouse here.
Mm.
Yeah. So this book starts with one of the young women being interviewed by the police. Actually, I think it's the FBI. She's a bit of a cool customer, this young woman. And she is a butterfly that has been rescued. And the two detectives, they're not 100% sure that she wasn't involved in some way with the killer because of how not forthcoming she is to help them with the investigation.
Okay.
So they can't figure her out. And this book takes you through her story because she starts telling her story to these detectives. And it cuts back and forth between the past and the present.
Oh, okay.
So I found this book, it's very unique in the serial killer genre. I will warn anyone out there, there are a ton of trigger warnings for this book. Like, if you are serious about it, just look up trigger warnings. Like it is not.
So if you are not into tattoos,
if you're sensitive at all about reading certain things, like, it might not be for you, is all I'm going
to
say.
I think all you'd have to do is read one sentence on the back of the book and you would know.
So. You might think maybe he's going to, the author, might skirt over some of the things that happen, but no, she doesn't just slide over those. She addresses
them. There's no skirting.
Yeah, I don't know why I used the word skirt.
Wearing beautiful butterfly skirts.
Who knows why I said that? But I found it a really fascinating, page-turning, just unique serial killer book. There are four books so far in the series, and this is the very first one.
Oh, it's a series.
It's a series, and it's about the detectives.
Okay.
Although this story wasn't at all about the detectives much. Hmm. It was about the story of the serial killer. So I don't know, because I haven't read the others.
Mm-hmm.
If they're just framed with that's how she tells the story with these guys.
Okay.
Now, Dave and Laura.
Yes.
You guys have some very disturbing reading choices. And I have to tell you, if the
this
apocalypse
one was disturbing.
Happens tomorrow,
yes.
We are parting ways.
This is the end.
All right. Well, you know, it's been nice knowing you. You're saying you're not going to be trapped in an underground bunker with us?
Oh, absolutely not.
Also, I'm the one who, as soon as I saw that 8-foot cavern, I was like, oh, it's a great place to store a body.
That's true.
In our backyard.
That was your
Everyone
first thought.
Everyone else is like,
Andrew and I were thinking about
treasure.
The buried treasure. You were thinking about the buried bodies.
You know, you have to trust your gut on these things.
So, if you're in the mood for this kind of book, and you know who you are.
I do. I would love that book. That sounds like a great book. Sometimes I get a little jealous when you're describing your book and you're giving your recommendation. Mm-hmm. I'm like, damn it. Why couldn't I have found that book first? That sounds like a good
the
book.
The other books in the series look great.
Yeah,
also,
very good. Excellent. Yeah. And that author is?
Dot Hutchinson.
All right. Very good. And that is recommended by?
Laura Medicus.
All right. My book this week.
Dave Medicus.
Also has a great title. And the title for this one is The Funny Thing About Norman Foreman. And this is written by Julieta Henderson. This book is, now listen, you got your dark, disturbing Will Dean book that we talked about. We got your dark, disturbing serial killer book. Andrew's over here casting all these aspersions, casting them my way, telling me about this horrific stuff that I read. Well, Andrew, I want you to sit up and I want you to listen and pay close attention to the book that I'm about to recommend right now. The Funny Thing About Norman Foreman. This book is a funny, charming, sweet, oftentimes laugh out loud funny book. Just what we have here is we have a heartwarming story about a young boy overcoming the loss of his best friend and his mother's attempt to really make him happy again. So right at the beginning of the book, we find out that 12-year-old Norman's inseparable and best friend, Jax, has just died. Really the only friend Norman has ever had. And the two of them had big plans. Their biggest was that within 5 years, they wanted to perform their comedy at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in Scotland. The book is set in England. Now, sadly...
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
So, you know, I listen to the Mark Maron's podcast. All I've ever heard about that festival is him complain about it. Just complain over and over
again. The drunk people.
How usually drunk people talks are. About. Yeah.
He says that the two drunk...
Yes.
Yes, but he says the other drunkest place... He always references two places.
The drunkest in the world.
The drunkest in the world. Number one, Edinburgh, Scotland. Andrew, want to guess number two? And this is a guy, a comedian who's traveled all around, performed all around the world.
Let me guess. Hang on. What is it? Pimlico Racetrack.
The day of the Preakness, the infield at Pimlico would be as far as sheer alcohol volume by body blood content, that would be the number one in the world. No, overall, he references Denver, Colorado as the other. Edinburgh, Scotland, and Denver, Colorado as the two drunkest places he's ever seen. And, you know,
he's never been to the Preakness, obviously.
No, never. No,
we need to get him out there. But anyway, in any case, so Norman and his friend Jax, they had big plans. They were going to go and perform their comedy act at the Fringe Festival. However, now with Jax passed away, this seems hopeless. And Norman has not only lost his friend, but he's really just kind of lost his, the joy that he took out of life. You know, you picture when you're a 12-year-old kid and you have, you know, there's someone who had just had, all he had his one best friend, and they did everything together, went everywhere, made these plans, had these little comedy act, and, you know, Jax was the funny one, and now Norman was the straight guy, and now he's left, you know, by himself.
How did he die?
You know what? It's not really something that, if it was mentioned, I don't remember.
Okay, so it wasn't like murder or anything.
No, we're not in thriller territory.
I wasn't sure what type of book. I wasn't sure if I believed you that it really wasn't.
You didn't believe me? Yes. Tell. Come on. If I'm going to call it funny and charming and sweet,
I thought you were building up to something.
I see. No, no, no.
Okay.
No, no,
okay.
No, I apologize.
Pardon me.
No. This is a very sweet, sweet book.
He died on stage doing stand up.
Thank you.
Okay. There you go. Exactly. So Norman's mom, a single mom, Sadie, she ends up unwittingly enlisting the help of her 80-something-year-old co-worker, Leonard. And before you know it, the three of them are hitting the road in search of an elusive spot at the extremely popular Fringe Festival. And this book turns into kind of like a road trip book. And now here's a kid in Norman who's already down, you know, a kid who's gotten the worst news you can possibly get. The worst thing that he could ever imagine happening to him has already happened. His best friend has died. And you don't want to, as you're reading this, you don't want to see him kicked while he's down. So here is a kid that you really, really root for. Although at the same time, you're like, how can he possibly succeed as a 12-year-old kid who, by his own admission, is not even funny? He's the straight man. And now, you know, they're on the road here, and this guy, this old guy, Leonard, has booked them into these little pubs so Norman can practice his stand-up, where he's never actually done any stand-up except for, you know, in a treehouse with
his
friend Jax, and he's the straight guy up there reading jokes. So you kind of read these scenes, and it's like you're reading it through, you know, through your fingers. Like you really want Norman to succeed, but you just know he's going to end up falling on his ass, or at least that's what you're afraid of. And it makes for quite the emotional heartstrings that gets tugged. So Norman, also I should mention, he's got a terrible case of psoriasis, and so that he's got that going for him as well. And he's the kind of kid who got picked on a lot in school. You know, Jax was all he had. It's one of these books where you keep asking yourselves, what? Here we go. He's getting ready to get up in a bar and do stand up. What could possibly go wrong? By the way, along the way on this odyssey, they're going to pop in and interview people who might be his biological father, because that was another thing that he wanted to get down. So Sadie's got a list of like three or four possibilities of who his biological father might be. I love the points of view in this book because we get Norman's side and we also get his mother's side of things. Both perspectives allow us to live vicariously through Norman and then also to see his mother looking at him. And as she wants just nothing more than to see him laugh again, to see him be happy the way he once was. This book really moved me while I was reading it. One minute I found myself laughing out loud at Norman's observations or the situations, and then the next minute, just out of nowhere, there'd be a sentence or two just describing what Norman was going through, and I literally felt tears well up as I'm reading it. It was just a sweet... It's sweet, the book. I mean, I hate to call a book sweet, but this really is a sweet book. It's kind. It's funny. I love this one. This is the opposite of your serial killer book. This has got a big, big heart to it. Oftentimes, I found myself laughing and crying at the same time. Really, really enjoyed this one. The Funny Thing About Norman Foreman by Julietta Henderson. Yes, Andrew?
So this reminds me of the movie, I think it's called Little Miss Sunshine or something like that.
I was thinking that too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know why, Andrew. I had the same thought. Yeah. Huh.
Now, were there humorous parts of this book?
But yeah. Did you? Yes. It's hilarious. Absolutely hilarious. Yes. I'm sorry if I didn't stress that enough. Absolutely. No, this was very funny. And Norman, so like every time he sees something that he finds funny, he wants to write it down for his comedy act. So he's constantly making these little observations. Yeah, very, very, very funny book. Really enjoyed it.
Cool.
All right, so check that one out. That's recommended by me, Dave Medicus. And next up is Andrew. What do you got for us this week?
So I have a science, well, not science fiction. It is a fantasy book. And so, you know, I feel like I haven't really done much fantasy for a while. It seems like it's been mostly science fiction.
Yeah, you know, last week I was the one who had to bring the fantasy book, the Bone House.
Well, I brought it this week. You inspired me, Dave.
The Bone Maker, Dave.
The Bone Maker, yes. The Bone Maker, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And this book is called The Awakening. It is by Robert M. Cairns, K-E-R-N-S, and it is part of the Histories of Drachmor series.
Wow.
Kearns.
Yep, and it is a, well, he goes by Robert M. Kearns, and I don't always, didn't want to shorten it to Bob because that's not what's on the book.
Well, you know, Robert De Niro goes by Bob, you know.
It's Robert, it is a svelte 398 pages. I mean, you know.
Oh, now, that's short for fantasy.
If you're going to write a book, 398 pages, you don't think you can write two more pages?
That's a good point. Get that 400 pages. Yeah.
Like maybe do
under 400.
Yeah. Put like a poem in the middle or something just to get it.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Or throw in some chapter titles, some blank pages with chapter titles.
He goes by Rob, by the way.
Rob, you're good friends with him?
No, on Goodreads, it says, or Rob, if you ever meet him in person.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
Call him RK.
Yeah. I'll let you call him RK.
RM Kearns. That would be the appropriate.
RM Kearns. Yeah.
RM Kearns.
Oh, right. Kearns.
The appropriate site, you know,
fantasy. Yeah.
Fantasy, yeah. Moniker. So the book concerns it is The Awakening. It is, wait for it, it is another apprentice magician novel.
Oh, now, love those.
It's actually wrong. Let me redact that. It is an apprentice wizard novel. Because in this book, of course, there are different types of magic. And, you know, Gavin Cross, the main character, he is a wizard. He is not a magician.
Okay.
Right? And there's differences, and the book explains that. And the book is a very well-written, it is a very intense, very detailed book that creates a very believable world that you can get immersed into. And so Gavin Cross wakes up on the streets of the city in Drachmor, and he does not know who he is. He has no memories. And there's an old guy there in a robes, and he says, "You really need to get going. Go that way." And then the guy disappears.
How fortuitous is that for someone who's just lost their memory? You need someone to point your direction.
You know, and I guess he's a little pissed off at this guy. I mean, who's this guy to tell me what to do? But he decides that, you know, it probably makes sense to go the direction the guy has told him. And so he starts going in that direction. Now, of course, he comes across one of the other main characters. Her name is Kiri. And Kiri is a slave who has stolen from her master and she has decided to run away from home. And so Kiri is no simple slave. She was the slave catchers almost had her, and you know, and some and they had her and they had a hold of her backpack, and somebody stepped in, killed the slave catcher, and Kiri got up, made a you know a slim escape, and so she is basically hiding in an alley, and of course Gavin comes across her, and she is stunning, and Gavin knows immediately that he is going to do whatever he can to help her.
All right.
And so now Kiri is not just a slave, right? And what happened is Kiri, several years earlier, washed up on the beaches. She was in a shipwreck, and she washed up on the beaches. And so whoever found her basically turned her into a slave.
Okay.
Right? And so she's been trying to basically flee from that lifestyle. And so there they are in the alley, and of course – the slave catchers catch up to them just as that. And so that is when Gavin's magic surfaces. And, you know, and you get to see some examples of his magic. And his magic is obviously, it is very strong. Of course, it is not quite like everybody else's magic, right? He's a little unique. He's a little different. I think we've seen that before.
Yeah.
That's right.
You know, I don't think there's a magician book out there, a magic book out there where like the main character's magic works exactly the same as everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, where it's kind of like always the mediocre magician. maybe we should write that book.
Oh, anyway, that's a great idea, yeah. Actually. I like that.
Let's not put that one out there. We need to cut that last bit so nobody steals that idea.
I love that. You know, that's a little bit Doug Adams, like Hitchhiker's Guide.
Yeah,
a little
sounds
bit.
Like it. Yeah. The mediocre magician.
Yeah.
So one of Gavin's spells is the guy's trying to turn Gavin into a slave. And so basically Gavin gets a little bit of revenge, right? And he doesn't know what he's doing. It's all just instinct to him. But of course, Gavin does not end up a slave. And then more slave people show up. And so Gavin basically casts really his first true spell. He utters a word that he only just recently learned. And it turns out that 53 slavers across the city die, right? And that's how powerful Gavin is.
Wow.
He's just like that. He utters a word and 53 people drop dead.
What was the word? What was the word?
You have to read the book.
Okay.
And it's funny. You know, you see these power words in the book. It's kind of like Dune where there's like the power words.
Oh.
And so, you know, but I didn't actually try those words out loud. Maybe after the podcast, I'm going to have to look those words up and
shout them from your back
test
balcony.
Them out.
Yeah.
I'll say them to the dog, and the dog's just going to look at me. You know, so we'll see if they look at me, if they have any power to them.
Mm.
So I bet you the power in those words is the dogs will come running. Of course, they come running for just about anything.
Sure. They think you're just yelling Twinkies.
Yeah. So basically this book, it starts out where you've got compelling characters that are fleeing. You don't really know what they're fleeing from. And then in steps a character who's larger than life. His name is Marcus, and he is a 6,000-year-old wizard.
Wow.
And Marcus seems like he has all the answers. And he really does. He doesn't seem.
Well, you've been around for 6,000 years. You're going to pick up a thing or two. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And you're probably going to forget. You're probably going to forget more than you.
Yes.
More than That's you remember. True. I can imagine. Yeah. I certainly would. But and so Marcus is unassuming, but he is so powerful that he laughs at the king. He laughs at any institution because he is more powerful than all of them. Right. And so these three characters get entwined in this book. And of course, Gavin becomes Marcus's apprentice, and he's the first apprentice that he's had in, you know, well over 1,000 years. And of course, there's gods in the book too. And the gods basically suggest to Marcus that Marcus, you must train him as only you can, right? Mm. Because only Marcus really knows the way, the old ways of the wizard, right? So, you know, this book's a little bit old school, you know, old school as well. And so, you know, there are politics in this book. There's intrigue. There is prophecy. There is hard justice in this book. So it's kind of good to see, you know, people like slavers get what they deserve.
Yeah.
There's also other atrocities that get committed in the book, and the people do get justice. And Gavin is also, he is essential to bringing justice. And it seems like that's why Gavin is there, is because he is trying to bring justice to this kingdom. And there's multiple kingdoms. It seems like they're at the brink of civil war. The institutions, much like those here in the United States, are close to failure. so maybe it strikes
a lot of parallels. A lot of parallels, you're saying.
Yeah, but there is great character development here, and this is just the first book in the series. So the book is Awakening. It is part one of the Histories of Drachmor novel.
All right, very good. And that was written by
Robert M. Kearns.
Okay, and recommended by
Andrew Dowd.
All right, very good. Sounds good. That means it is time now for our
Audiobook of the Week.
Audiobook of the Week, and my pick this week is Summertime Guests. Summertime Guests, which is a novel by Wendy Francis, narrated by Kate Marson. So this is a good, a beach read. I guess you could call this a fun beach read, an interesting beach read. It's a novel that takes place over the course of 3 days at the swanky Seafarer Hotel in Boston, where if you go, you might even catch a glimpse of Ray Romano packing in or checking in or hanging out, as one of the characters in this book does. And speaking of characters, this is really a character-driven novel as we follow four different storylines over the course of these 3 days, with just a nice little bit of mystery slash intrigue thrown in. As we do know, we find this out early on, a woman has fallen to her death from a balcony at the hotel. We just don't know who it was, or if it was an accident, if it was suicide, murder, or what happens. The book goes back and forth in time during these 3 days, though most of it occurs in the days and day leading up to the death. And I really enjoyed how we go back and forth, especially, it's quite the juggling act that an author has to do when you've got these four different storylines and then you've got these three different days and we're going back and forth. And the way that she's able to do it to keep you interested and still knowing your place in the story as we jump around takes a lot of skill, mm-hmm. and is something that I really appreciated. So who are these characters? They are Riley. We get Riley. Now, she is there with her fiance. They're planning their future wedding, although she's not always in agreement with what her mother-in-law wants. You've got Claire. Claire is an older journalist who, for some reason, is on the outs at her job. We don't know why, but we gradually find out what's going on there, this newspaper she writes for, and what happened on her job to get her in trouble. Also, she's a bit obsessed with tracking down an old boyfriend of hers. We follow along with Jean-Paul. Jean-Paul is and the narrator here does a great job with the French accent. Sometimes you can get too much with the French, like I'm doing right now. She keeps it nice and subtle, as he and his wife both are French, and we get the tasty French accent. Now, he's dealing with the dead body, as he's the hotel manager. And he also has a new baby in his life and some struggles as he is having with his wife, the new mother. And then finally you get Gwen and Jason. They are on a romantic getaway for the weekend, only Jason is not quite feeling it. Why, it turns out he's got some anger issues, and he also found himself in some hot water at work. He's a professor, and he's there lecturing to the kids. They're not really following along with what he's saying about the Bolsheviks. He kind of snaps at them and gives them the old, "All right, fine, then you're on your own. I'll see you in a month at the final." And kind of storms out. And then, of course, one kid files a complaint against him. So there's that going on. This is a well-written, well-crafted story, very much character-driven and relationship-driven, as each different couple or storyline is given plenty of time to shine, and we go deep into their problems and issues that plague each one of them. And I think it's easy for a reader to relate to a lot of what's going on here in the book. The mystery is interesting as well, as we try to figure out who exactly it is that plunged to their death. And like I mentioned, the structure, I really enjoyed the structure. juggling the four different storylines there. So this is a really fun listen and interesting. Let's take a listen to a clip. This is Summertime Guests by Wendy Francis, narrated, performed by Kate Marson.
Just because there has been a tragic accident doesn't mean that everything comes to a halt. To the contrary, the show, as they say, must go on. So after Jean-Paul checks in with Jillian one more time, he does a quick sweep of the rest of his staff. Housekeeping, maintenance, food and beverage. Rumors have been circulating about the woman on the 10th floor. Was she part of a couple? Did she come alone? Was she on drugs? He calls a quick staff meeting in the wing beyond his office. When he looks out on the faces of his crew, so many of them personal friends, he has to remind himself to don his manager hat.
Thank you all for taking a moment to meet with me. I understand the temptation to speculate on what may have happened this afternoon is great, he begins, and waits for the crowd to settle. But please, I'm asking, indeed advising you, not to make that grave mistake.
All right, there you go. That is your audiobook of the week, and that'll do it for us this week. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thanks to Will Dean for hopping back on. Always great to talk to him. Check out his book, The Last Thing to Burn. That'll do it for us this week. My name is Dave Medicus. Thanks for listening.
Adios.
You can learn many things from children. How much patience you have, for instance. Franklin P. Jones.
Honey was getting high off the spider plant.